From Washington, VOA presents Issues in the News.
Welcome to Issues in the News. On the panel this week, Linda Feldman, Washington Bureau Chief for the Christian Science Monitor, Tom DeFrank, contributing editor to the National Journal, and our moderator, Michael Williams, contributor to CBS Radio in Washington.
Welcome, everyone. Here are the issues. The impeachment trial of U.S. President Donald Trump concluded with the U.S. Senate voting not guilty on both counts, ending a process that highlighted the deep political divides in the government and in the populace. On the day before his acquittal, President Trump gave his annual State of the Union address, delivering a speech that at times seemed more like a campaign rally. But the night will likely be remembered as much for the tense interactions between Trump and Speaker of the House Nancy Pelosi on that night and in the days that followed. And the 2020 presidential race got off to a rocky official start as the Iowa caucuses produced results that were delayed for days and produced results that were contested by virtually every candidate. But the candidates had no time to catch their breath with the New Hampshire primary looming just days away. Panelists, welcome. Today, even as we sit here, and for the last 3 years we've used so many times, I know I have, an extraordinary week in politics. This is with a capital E. I think it's just one for the history books, for the record books, both positively and negatively, I can say. Let's start with the acquittal. The trial ended virtually, as everyone would thought, with the acquittal on both counts. The votes were clearly not there for the beginning for conviction. And certainly with the Senate choosing not to hear witnesses, new witnesses, and not to introduce new documents into the process. It made that acquittal all but a certainty. But despite the lack of drama, it seemed that it did produce some moments of drama and of history. I'll start with you. Acquittal, no surprise, correct?
Correct. He needed to be convicted. We would have had to have two-thirds of the Senate. That's 67 senators. And with Republicans already having a majority, it was impossible. But we thought it was going to sail right into acquittal with nothing all that interesting. But surprise, Mitt Romney, a senator from Utah, and the Republican Party's 2012 nominee for president, decided to vote convict. He gave a very moving speech from the Senate floor, cited his deep religious faith. He's a member of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. And he just felt that he had to do what he had to do. It was a vote of conscience. Thus, Donald Trump's perhaps perfect week was ruined.
He denied the full party acquittal, the
Correct.
Unanimous acquittal that he had sought. And at some point, the Republicans were even looking for Democrats that might have crossed over in states that had voted heavily for Trump in the last presidential election. West Virginia, Doug Jones of Alabama, Joe Manchin, Senator Joe Manchin from West Virginia, among them. Romney's vote, again, he voted to acquit on one count, which was the abuse of power, right, and not for obstruction of Congress. You've seen these things before. How extraordinary was that vote?
It's extraordinary with a capital E and underscored and exclamation points, because there's not a lot of profiles and courage in this town anymore. And it's become even more difficult in the Trump era, because President Trump has a cadre of very loyal and very passionate followers, and he has made it clear that if Republicans cross him, they can be prepared to suffer the consequences. I think part of the Republican vote in the Senate was, some of it was principled. Some senators just didn't think what he did rose to the level of an impeachable offense. But what I heard and others have been hearing for months is that Republican senators are afraid of him. Trump wields power, and he has made it clear, you stick with me or you pay a price. I thought it was not at all a coincidence that within minutes of Senator Romney voting to convict on one of the accounts, Donald Trump Jr. put out a tweet saying Romney is not just a failed presidential candidate, he should be expelled from the Republican Party.
Yeah, and there's been more invective that's even a little more bitter and vulgar than that coming from various parts of the of the Trump cadre.
So Romney's, what he described as a principled decision, was also a a gutsy decision because he will pay a price. Now, they're not going to recall him. Utah is not going to recall him. He's not going to be expelled from the Republican caucus, but he's going to be messed up. He's going to do some suffering. I think he's pretty bulletproof. But
in the Senate is going to change for him. I mean, mm-hmm. it definitely is. It's not going to be the same that he was before.
I don't think Romney's going to be looking for to see a lot of White House invitations,
to put it mildly, indeed. Linda?
Yeah, no, I mean, the only question that it raises for me is, I mean, I think Mitt Romney is 72 years old. I don't think he's ever planning on running for president again. But is whether he can still be an effective representative of Utah in Donald Trump's permanent doghouse. Forget about White House invitations. I mean, can he, aside from just voting, what other power does he have? So the interesting thing about Utah is that they don't love Donald Trump in Utah. It is a very deeply Republican state. But because of its predominance of the Mormon faith in that state, and a lot of Mormons are not wild about Donald Trump for religious reasons. They don't like his...
Right. It matters of character.
The morality
and
question looms large for them. And so Donald Trump isn't wildly popular, and I think that gives Romney some kind of cushion.
And you know, it's interesting to me that when House lead manager Adam Schiff had mentioned during some of his comments that he had heard reports that Republicans who dared to cross the line and vote against Trump in any way would face their quote-unquote head on a pike. Mm-hmm. You know, they would face retribution. Certain senators took offense to that. And immediately after Romney crossed the line, his proverbial head was on a pike. So it seems as though all of that kind of came true. Let's go back to the case itself. Because as we say, the acquittal was all but a done deal based on the votes that were there. And certainly was not going to happen without anybody like John Bolton, former National Security Advisor John Bolton, whose book is still looming out there on the horizon, and his information that he has about what went on in the room. Apparently, Pat Cipollone, the White House counsel, who was one of the attorneys for the president, was in the room when these plans were being made to make deals with Ukraine in exchange for campaign favors. The Democrats didn't prove their case to the Senate, but did they prove their case to the people that matter, which are the voters? Because ultimately now this is going to come down to the voters. Did they prove their case convincingly to the voters?
Well, going into before the votes were taken, public opinion polls showed that about 70 to 72% of the American people wanted the Senate to call witnesses and to provide and to have consider new documents. And it was almost 50-50 split among the American people about whether Trump should be convicted and removed from office. I mean, it was like a 52 to 48 range. And so the country was as polarized as on impeachment and conviction as it is on just about everything else.
Yeah.
So I think you could say they probably made the case to half the country, and half the country that didn't think they made the case are Trump voters. So
we think that no minds were changed. They really didn't move anybody off
right,
their mark.
Right, but I think there's another key aspect here, and that is Donald Trump's job approval rating did go up. He got a little impeachment bounce. Mm. So it's similar to Bill Clinton back in 1999
yes.
when he was impeached and his job approval soared to 70%. I mean, Donald Trump is locked into a pretty steady job approval, but he did get to 49% in the Gallup poll.
Mm-hmm. It will be interesting.
That was his highest level.
It will be interesting to see whether his take no prisoners performance in the East Room towards the end of the week will cause those numbers to float back down, which I know we're coming to here.
Yeah, and we are getting to that in a moment. But before we leave the subject of the trial, so you had House oversight to the extent that they were able to do it. You had the case brought before the Senate, and now you have a not guilty verdict on two counts. What is the future of oversight with the rest of this presidency?
So the investigations aren't ending. The Democrats are likely to call John Bolton to testify, and the Republicans in the Senate say they're going to go after witnesses. They want to go after the whistleblower, the person who launched this whole thing and reported the call that Trump had with the president of Ukraine. So this isn't over at all.
We're just starting. We're almost starting like an investigative branch of government.
Right.
It's like a new
nonstop investigation.
Nonstop investigations. And with Nancy Pelosi holding the power to do that in the House, you have Mitch McConnell, the House a Senate Majority Leader being able to do the same thing. And you have a very, very, very active Trump supporter in Lindsey Graham, who is ready to call all kinds of hearings and call for all kinds of information. It does like this is getting ready to be a political food fight.
There's no doubt about it, Michael. Ironically, everybody seems energized here. The House Democrats, the Senate Republicans, the Trump White House, they're all going to keep this going. I mean, there's no, you get a feeling there's no lessons learned from anybody.
It's funny that you use that term, because several of the senators who chose to vote not guilty had said that they felt Lamar Alexander won. Susan Collins, I think it was another one, had said that they felt that Donald Trump from this would learn a lesson. Linda, I'll let you have the last word. What lessons were learned?
Well, here? I'm not sure any lessons were learned. And Susan Collins, she said she believed that he might modify his behavior. And then the next day, she walked that back. She's a senator from Maine in a tough re-election fight. She walked it back and said, well, that was aspirational on her part, that she hopes he's learned a lesson. But I think nobody else is even going as far as she is.
Yeah, and hope and change was Obama's slogan. I didn't know that would carry over to this administration. We're going to take a break, and we'll be back with more Issues in the News.
Issues in the News is coming to you from the Voice of America in Washington. If you would like to download the program, it's free on iTunes. Just click on the iTunes tab on our website. That's voanews.com. While you're there, check out our other programs, Press Conference USA and Encounter. Also, visit us on Facebook and leave a comment or two. Then like us at Current Affairs with Carol Castiel. Now back to our panel, Linda Feldman, Washington Bureau Chief for the Christian Science Monitor, Tom DeFrank, Contributing Editor to the National Journal, and our moderator, Michael Williams, Contributor to CBS Radio in Washington.
Welcome back. Again, a remarkable week produced a remarkable exchange of statements and speeches between Donald Trump and Speaker of the House Nancy Pelosi. It began with, I would say, generously the most peculiar State of the Union that I've ever seen. Then a speech given by the president at the National Prayer Breakfast in Washington, D.C. It's sort of the prayer lobby, in a way, I kind of call it, that meets annually, where Trump lashed out at his enemies, real and perceived, particularly Pelosi and Senator Romney. Pelosi responded with some scathing criticism of her own at her weekly press conference, calling the State of the Union a manifesto of lies and suggesting that the president might have been sedated somehow during the speech. And finally, the president took a victory lap in the East Room of the White House and gave a profanity-laced tirade that was heavy with both accusations and warnings of retribution, quite frankly. Tom, I'll start with you. Where to start? The State of the Union? You pick a place.
Well, State of the Union, I think. I've never heard a State of the Union quite like that. Now, it was really a campaign rally, but it was more sober than a campaign rally. But he basically was ticking off all the good things he and his administration has done. He reiterated all of his main campaign pledges, and he basically said more of the same. It was a little more measured only because he didn't do a lot of name calling there. He reserved that for 2 days later. But it was a strong, a powerful, and an oftentimes belligerent State of the Union. Whatever it was not a let's come together, bind up the nation's wounds. This was not a healing speech. This was we're coming after you speech. And I think that he set the tone for what we've all heard in campaign rallies. And I think this is going to be the tone for the next 9 months until the election.
Yeah, I mean, it was literally given to one half of the room. The president turned his body and faced the Democrats only to emphasize a point once it was given or to acknowledge the applause that was coming from the Republican side of the room. And then there was this sense of these guests being invited, which started with President Reagan, I believe,
right,
and has now escalated to the point where I think that is pretty much what defined this one, with people being given awards and scholarships. I mean, your thoughts on that?
Right. It was
who's
classic.
Okay with that, and who
it was? Well, it was a made-for-TV moments. Conservative talk radio host Rush Limbaugh, who's just been diagnosed with advanced lung cancer, was awarded on the spot the Medal of Freedom, the highest civilian honor you can get in the United States. You know, and both sides actually, it wasn't just Trump, and it wasn't just Republican actions designed to create moments. The Democrats, when Trump, in one of his few moments calling for bipartisanship, he called for action on health care, no surprise billing, and lower drug prices. And that immediately summoned Democrats to start heckling him. I've never seen that. And gesturing. This was planned.
I believe the chant was H.R. 3.
H.R. 3, which is legislation that's already been passed in the House to lower drug prices. And I think the larger point is that we're starting to see Democrats engage in Trumpian actions, stunts. And the question is whether that's a good idea. Are they all getting down into the muck? And then there was the most famous moment of all when Nancy Pelosi took her printed copy of the speech and ripped it in half on TV right after the speech had ended. And thus, the Democrats are in the muck with Donald Trump.
Yeah, they are. And even before that, when a lot of people did not notice that the speaker chose not to give the traditional recognition of the president when introducing him, saying mm-hmm. it's my high honor and distinct privilege. It was just simply the president of the United States. And this after he had snubbed her for a handshake.
Right. We don't know. He appeared to snub her. She extended her hand.
He appeared.
And then he turned away. We don't know that he saw her hand and rejected it. But
very true. This is what things appear to be.
Right.
And again, but appearances count for everything.
Right.
And as you say, it was a made-for-television show, and now the Democrats have decided to participate. At the prayer breakfast, the president commented on Nancy Pelosi and Mitt Romney, accusing them of being essentially hypocrites in their faith, that Pelosi, who said that she prays for the president, that she doesn't really, that Mitt Romney is hiding behind his faith. The president then went immediately to the East Room of the White House and uttered a profanity in the East Room of the White House, describing his thoughts about the Mueller investigation and other investigations that have been directed towards him. Where's this all going? I mean, Nancy Pelosi said, "I feel liberated," at some mm-hmm. point during her press mm-hmm. conference. President Trump clearly feels that he has given free license. He's been given free license to stay and do whatever he wants by his party faithful. Mm-hmm. Where is this going? How low can we go in terms of this thing? Because we're just starting here at the beginning of the presidential campaign.
We can go lower.
Right.
There's no doubt about it. The president feels emboldened. He feels that he has been totally exonerated. So that's a phrase he's taken to using here. And the Democrats, I think, are so angry. They clearly think that he is a bad guy. He thinks they're horrible people. He called Speaker Pelosi a couple of times a horrible person. He called other government officials at the top level scum. I mean, this was...
It's also very personal. And it's still, mm-hmm. after all this time, after all 3 years, and we've seen this over and over and over again, mm-hmm. for so many people, I think those of us who have been around this for a long time, it can't help but strike a nerve and strike a chord. And I think I'm overly sensitive.
I think what we're seeing is we've got Donald Trump and Nancy Pelosi. Think of them as generals speaking to their troops. So you have to ask yourself, why is Nancy Pelosi stooping to Trump's level? I think because she has to. Her party is in disarray, and she needs to keep everybody with her. And they can't stand Donald Trump. And even if she herself might prefer a more genteel approach, she has to keep her troops with her, especially the kind of the left wing of the party. And that, I think, is why she's behaving this way and being very vituperative toward the president.
Yeah, she talked about maintaining her dignity, that she always wanted to maintain her dignity. And I think that even with her tearing up of the speech, she felt that was a dignified act, you know, in her world, maybe been outside the box for her four years ago, eight years ago, but maybe even a week ago. But
I mean, she is a very dignified lady, but she's also very, very politically shrewd. I mean, you can second guess her, but I think she knows what she's doing.
And just to get back again to the State of the Union and sort of the core of the speech and the meat of it, because this was essentially a kickoff of the campaign. And you talked about the statistics and circumstances that were laid out. And I will hesitate to call them facts because there's been a lot of fact-checking on them, and many of them were somewhat off the mark. How will the Democrats use that sort of thing? Because the president does have the bully pulpit, and he gets the first crack at it. How do they get swing voters to recognize when a fact is not necessarily a fact, when it's not correct, for whatever reason?
Well, I think they're going to have to spend more money on ads than television ads than they were expecting, because, you know, you can't get into a a lot of details about all these half-truths and exaggerations that the president is noted for. I mean, for instance, it's really interesting that who would have believed this? The economy is roaring, there's no doubt about it, and there's also no doubt the president deserves credit for that. But it's also true that in the last 3 years of the Obama administration, more jobs were created than the first 3 years of the Trump administration. So, I mean, the bottom line is, you're right, Michael, the Democrats have got to figure out a way to break through with independents and moderates. Trump's base will believe anything he says every time he says it. And there are millions of Democrats and others who loathe him and won't believe anything he says. So the key is going to be not just turnout, but turning out independents and moderates who can assess Trump's charges and deal with them. So we'll see. It's going to be a hard slog and a nasty, vicious slog all the way to the election.
And speaking of which, we'll turn to the Democratic caucuses and primaries, both of which are happening virtually at the same time. The schedule gets very compressed right now, the political schedule. What was supposed to be a celebration of democracy turned into a complete nightmare for Democratic officials in Iowa as a new technology and old technology failed completely, leaving the results of the caucuses in question, again, days after they had been held. We have a winner now, though. I think we finally have had final results come in, I had heard on some reports.
Well,
are we still out there with 99%, 98%?
I think it's 100%. Reporting, but the numbers are maybe a little fishy. But I think all elections are messy, okay? Never look at it too, and the danger comes when it's super close.
Right.
So this one was super duper close, and let's call it a tie.
Let's call it a tie.
Pete Buttigieg, the former mayor of South Bend, Indiana, who's, I think, 38, 39 years old, young guy, gay, up against Bernie Sanders, the 78-year-old senator from Vermont, not even a Democrat.
Yeah.
They are the two front runners, and they're now in New Hampshire, and Bernie Sanders is going to win New Hampshire. He's the senator from the neighboring state,
right?
Likely to win New Hampshire.
Right.
You know, I think one of the shocking but not completely unexpected results was that Joe Biden, the former vice president, did very poorly in Iowa and is running on fumes and is likely not to make it much longer.
Well, he said it was a gut punch.
It was a gut punch. He was acknowledging that. And Elizabeth Warren is fading, so this may be down to just two people.
Tom, winners and losers?
I couldn't agree more with Linda on this. Joe Biden was a huge loser coming in fourth. A big winner was Donald Trump. Trump is salivating at the prospect of running against Bernie Sanders. As a matter of fact, he's been defending Bernie Sanders now and then, and his aides have been talking Sanders up. Why? Because they believe that if Sanders is the Democratic nominee, Trump's going to win 40 states, and they would love that. Now, overnight is a lifetime in politics. You've both heard me say it many times, and there are many instances in political history where front runners have gotten clobbered and somehow pulled themselves off the mat. I remember the night well, February the 8th, 1988, Vice President Bush was running, and it was the Iowa caucuses, and he got his clock cleaned by Kansas Senator Robert Dole, and it looked like Bush, the incumbent vice president, endorsed by Ronald Reagan. He pulled it out. John Sununu, who was a former governor of New Hampshire, said, "You can win in New Hampshire, but you have to listen to me. Don't listen to all the idiots around you. I will show you how to win." And in the space of 10 days, Bush turned it around, stabilized his situation by winning New Hampshire. Now, it's going to be a tall order for Biden to win New Hampshire, but he's got to stop the free fall, because he thinks that if he can hang in there till South Carolina, where he's expected to win, he can stabilize, but he's got to do something quickly. The other thing I'll say very quickly, the other big development that's got to be troublesome for Democrats is the turnout was not great in Iowa.
Yeah.
And the enthusiasm from 2018 was not manifested in 2020. And that's a trend that the Democrats are going to have to worry about a lot.
I'll finish with you, Linda. Who's more likely to come out of New Hampshire viable, Joe Biden or Senator Amy Klobuchar?
Oh, gosh, I don't think either is viable. But I will say Amy Klobuchar has gotten a lot of notice in this race. moderate woman senator from Minnesota, a heartland state that Trump almost won 4 years ago. She could be a top prospect for running mate for the eventual Democratic nominee.
I totally agree. I think one of the other winners who's not on the ballot in Iowa, well, he was on the ballot there, let's say that. One of the guys who's the winner we haven't talked about is Mike Bloomberg.
Yes.
And it's sort of fascinating that the election is so focused on three 70-year-old New Yorkers who grew up within about a 10-mile radius of each other.
Mm-hmm.
Kind of fascinating out of this great big country that's what we're up against. So, unfortunately, that's all the time we have for this week. Thanks to our panel, Linda Feldman, Washington Bureau Chief for the Christian Science Monitor, and Tom DeFrank, Contributing Editor to the National Journal. This program is produced by VOA's Kim Lewis. Our engineer is Justin Thwaites. And I'm Michael Williams. Thanks for listening.